you sound pretty down on the idea of disclosure happening anytime soon. Are you hopeful?
I don't think I'll live my lifetime to see it.
Oh, really?
Oh, no, never.
Now, what about me? I'm 25.
you might. I mean, I think if something accidental happens, or if they're able to, you got to see the scenario. Either people are able to marshal a voting group that's able to influence politicians. And some politicians told Stephen Greer, you get the people out front and we'll back you. It's like, as soon as the people are there, as soon as the votes are there, we're on your side and we're going to come public, but not until. Because why would you, I mean, you're there to vote. Why would you spend your energy and effort on something that's going to get you no votes and might actually lose you a pile of votes?
Yeah.
So unless you get a marshaling or you get an accidental crash where they're not able to control the information, or if you get a situation where those are about the only two scenarios I can see that you might get disclosure. The government will not disclose, because I don't think the government really controls it. I think there's people inside the government that control it.
Yeah.
Bill Clinton says a government inside the government. But if gas goes very, very high, if suddenly the bottom falls out of the energy, I think you're going to get enough pressure where people are going to realize that we need more than hydrogen energy, we need more than wind power energy, that we've got to disclose this kind of thing. People are going to start to politicians are going to realize there's enough votes there that we should push the issue. But I'm very, very sort of down on disclosure. And yet I believe disclosure should come. I believe it's the best thing that can happen. I believe what Stephen Greer says, that there's nothing right about lying to people. That basically the truth is always the way to go. So basically I tell the truth. For example, I have this scenario that I was banned from the United States on a lecture.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, actually.
Yeah, I was going down and I was stopped at, I flew to Vancouver and I was flying to Los Angeles to make a lecture on the 64 reasons why the government decided to keep this secret. And Homeland Security told me I didn't have the proper travel papers. I didn't have a work visa for my $100 honorarium, and they basically shut me down, sent me back home again. I flew back home, and that's all that happened there. But I'm in a situation where I was kept out, and it was the UFO community really didn't back me. There were some people who were sympathetic to it.
The incident at the border is really what I was going to ask you about. And also, 2 months later, that happened 2 months ago, right?
Yeah, September 2nd.
Yeah, so it's been 2 months. You probably had a lot of time to reflect on it and maybe to get some more information. And since you were sort of going that way, how did ufology react to what happened to you?
Okay, looking back after 2 months, I sort of assume it was I ran into a Homeland Security person who wasn't a big fan of UFOs and basically was going by the book, because I when I talked to them, I said, well, I've done lots of lectures in the United States. I've never needed a work permit to go across. I'm very honest. And people told me, they said, well, you should have gone to the border, you should have told me you were just going for vacation. And I said, well, if I did that, if I went there and lied to Homeland Security, why would you believe anything that I told you when I get to the other end of the line, when I lecture?
Yeah.
And so I basically told them everything that was going on. I had exactly what I was getting paid, exactly what was going on, what lecture, when it was, all the schedules, all this sort of stuff. And basically I think I ran into somebody who was very antagonistic to UFOs, because he was very cynical. It was a very humiliating experience. The guy was very rude.
Oh, man.
And basically, like, for example, when I asked him, well, what do I do now? He said, I don't really care what you do. You can go back where you came from. And stuff like that. Basically, they say that they won't treat you like that. And so it sort of put me in a situation where I believe that it may not have been an intentional thing. And that again, there was another guy who was making a lecture. He was a reporter out of England who was not one of the embedded reporters. He refused to be embedded in the U.S. military forces when they were in Iraq during the invasion, and went running around and made a bunch of stories that were not very sympathetic to what was the Americans were doing there. And he was also banned about 3 or 4 weeks later. He was making a speech in California, and he was banned for the same reason. He was kicked out because he didn't have the right papers to lecture. So I think there may be some sort of indirect thing. Now, last weekend I went across the border again, and I was held for 40 minutes. I was put in a little glass room.
Oh,
and
really?
Was, you know, given the 64 questions, and the car was, we went to a compound, the car was, you know, done, but they did let me across, and I was just going to shop. But, so I sort of faced that. It's something that at the border, sometimes I've actually, in fact, when I went to speak at Ozark in April, I actually ran into a customs officer who was actually interested. And I said, I'm going to disclose, you know, what the presidents know about UFOs. And she said, well, what do they know? And she's asking me all these questions. And meanwhile, the lineup's piling up behind me, and this woman wants to know what's going on. So a lot of it depends on who you run into. I don't think, I was told by one Canadian customs person who was contacted that they got bigger fish to fry than the UFO people. You know, they're looking for terrorists and weapons and this sort of
thing. So you don't think it was that you're like on a blacklist or anything like that? You just think you ran into a...
Yeah, I think that probably. Although once this other guy was kicked out, I seem to think that there was a chance that I actually was targeted. Now, it's almost impossible for me now to lecture in the States. It has to do with how to get the work visa that I have to go 900 miles to be, because I've been refused entry to the United States. I have to go and be interviewed by a consulate officer in order to get a work visa, and the closest consulate is 900 miles away. So for $100 honorarium to speak, am I going to fly 900 miles to be interviewed by a consulate officer and get a visa to go make one little speech? So you're sort of stuck in a situation where I plan to move in a few years, and then I'm in a situation where I'm close to a consulate. I can, but I'm sort of blacklisted. But it did sort of make me sort of famous. It's sort of like the UFO community is a very conspiratorial community. Everybody believes the government's out to get them, and this sort of reinforced everybody's conviction that they're out to get us.
Yeah.
So with that community, I was very sort of their hero. That this proves our point that they're out to get us.
But you said you didn't feel like you got the support that you should have from your
Absolutely none. I mean, I from the people that you would expect, like Ryan Wood was very supportive. He actually sent me money to pay for a lawyer. I was going to go to a lawyer to try to fight this. Bryant out of Washington, Larry Bryant, who's very vocal. I had a bunch of people, Minnesota people, wrote letters to congressmen and stuff, but I knew that stuff really wouldn't go anywhere because congressmen, it's the old story. Congressmen get, I can't remember what it was, it's like 5,000 emails a day or something like this, and people don't realize how the game is played. Ufologists especially have to realize that unless you do it in writing and you actually sign your name, it means nothing. They basically delete all those emails. People want to do it the easy way. Let's send an email to 300 congressmen and legislators and do it one way, but that stuff is just totally ignored.
Yeah.
And I think we have to sort of learn from other communities, whether it's Greenpeace or gay rights or AIDS research or all these people who were once on the outside and now are on the inside with government funding and government support and stuff like that, that you have to realize that it wasn't an easy ride for anybody, that in order to get this thing on the map, we're going to have to do some work. And then until we do the work, we don't deserve to know the answer. If we're lazy and do stupid things like send emails and stuff, that nothing's going to happen, that we're trying to take the shortcut, that we have to stand up and ask the questions that might be embarrassing. We have to get people on our side. And the problem there is that I think the average person, whether it's my friends that came the second night that I saw this thing and said to me, Cameron, you're crazy, we're going home, or hungry, we want pizza. People who, it's really not an issue. It doesn't affect their pocketbook. It's an interest thing that you can't marshal those people to go to Washington, D.C. Their kids didn't die in battle. They don't have any real reason. They didn't lose their house. They didn't get wiped out in a hurricane. They've got no real reason to join our cause, because it's not costing them. And once it costs people, and that's where they say no pain, no gain, that, sometimes, as I always told my kid, I sort of believe that God created pain for a reason, that when we get enough pain in the UFO community and when society feels enough pain on this issue, whether it's lack of oil or whatever it is, or enough just destruction to the earth, that when there's enough pain, then people are going to realize we have to have this, and then you're going to get the answer. But not until. People aren't suffering. Even at $3 a gallon for gas, people still driving their cars. It's like that costs them a little bit more. Big deal. Let's just keep going. But if gas is $30 or $40 a gallon, then you're going to see the attitude change. And it's going to be much easier to get someone to go to Washington, D.C. with you and stand outside the White House with little picket signs and say, we want free energy. We believe you've got the answer. And you're just allowing corporations to make money on this thing. And we want the answer, and we want you to release it now. People have to have a reason. And I can't blame them that they're not interested. There's just no reason for them to do it.
Now, do you think with the free energy, they could sort of, that's sort of like that's an addition to the UFO phenomenon. Is there a chance that the free energy would get pushed through, but the UFO secret would still remain in secret? They could be like, hey, we have free energy from...
No. That's one thing Stanton Friedman has said. I tend to disagree, and that is Stanton Friedman has said that you could release the fact that UFOs are real, but the classified stuff are not going to release, which they do on other stuff. I say, and is one of the things that stops them from releasing, is the fact that at no time can you make any admission whatsoever, because then you spill the milk and you can't get it back in the glass. There's no turning back. The minute the president, like, for example, people say, the president can stand up and say, UFOs are real and I can't talk about the rest. Absolutely won't happen.
Yeah.
Within an hour, there's going to be 2,000 trucks with little dishes and going to CNN and just an avalanche of reporters, and they're going to be ready with hundreds of questions.
Yeah.
And they're going to want to know. You're not going to get away with just UFOs are real and we won't talk about the rest. You're going to have a situation where, as I always said, one of the main things they're afraid of is that once you make any sort of admission that this thing is for real and the president confirms this, within the first 5 questions or 10 questions, someone's going to say, Mr. President, you are constitutionally responsible for the protection of the American people. It has been estimated that 3, 5, 8 million, whatever figure they use, say 3, 5, 6 million people have been abducted by these aliens. Mr. President, what are you doing to stop that? The president does not only know not how to stop it, he doesn't even know why they're doing it.
Yeah.
You're going to have someone stand up, Mr. President, it's been estimated that 10,000 cattle have been mutilated. The ranchers are very upset about this. Mr. President, are you going to do something about this? Are you going to pay these people back? Are you going to give them their money for the cattle? You have so many issues that the president can't answer. And that's one of the things I think is the problem, is that the president or the people who are running it really don't know what's going on. You take a look at this technology. The more you look at the technology, the more the aliens reveal what's actually involved, the more complex the technology looks.
Yeah.
And you start to think that the government, that the people who are actually in control of the thing probably still only know 5%. I mean, I think if they could stop abductions, they could stop them. They would do it. They can't stop abductions. They don't know how to do this. They everything's out of control. The aliens can still fly around at will. We can't shoot them down. They can hover around military bases. They've shown that they can do what they want. They are running the show. And that kind of stuff, the president can't admit. You can never have the president standing up in answer to a question and saying, when a president is briefed, if you see how a president is briefed, when they do the briefing, you see Ronald Reagan, because he was a very controlled president, they were very afraid of what he would say on different issues. They would basically give him the answer to the questions. And then a lot of these guys have photographic memories. They're very good with details, and they can remember what the answer to the question is. So they're going to basically brief the president. If they know disclosure has happened, say the president says UFOs are real, I'm not going to talk about the rest. You suddenly get 5,000 phone calls to the White House press room, and they want an interview, they want a press thing, and you got to do something. So then you got to brief the president. And there's probably 5% of the things they got answers for. The other 95, they don't. And you're not going to put the president when you can only answer 5 out of 100 questions.
Yeah.
And it's going to make the president look like he's stupid. It's going to make it look like they have no control over the situation. And then the panic breaks out. And when the panic breaks out, then you have situations, and this may not happen, it may happen. You get a situation where, say, somebody says, well, oil's worth nothing. I remember Wilbur Smith's chief metallurgist told me, he said, I'll tell you what, Grant. He said, if you know they're going to release the UFO secret tomorrow, I want to tell you, and I'm telling you this for a fact, you sell everything you got, because everything you got is going to be worth nothing. And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, I'm just telling you, if you know they're going to release the UFO secret tomorrow, you sell everything you got, because everything you got is going to be worth nothing. And I never, ever really thought about that for 25 years. Then Stephen Greer came out and talked about the fact the stock market would crash. And you take a look at what happened.
Yeah.
They say people wouldn't panic. People panicked during 9/11. The stock market crashed. They had to shut the stock market. And what happened with the stock market was they were able to convince the people, we've got marshals on planes. We've got it, and if anybody comes on a plane and tries to go over the plane, they're going to shoot them. We've got these people and they're armed. And you sort of convince the people, well, yeah, okay, I'd get on a plane. They got marshals on the plane. They're not going to be able to do this again. And you sort of convince the people that the situation has changed and we've got it under control.
Yeah.
The same happens with the blackout. People panicked during the blackout a couple of years back in the New England states. And people panicked and they had to shut the stock market again. So then you get a situation where they say, okay, now we know what caused the blackout and we've got it under control. We've got some of the lights back on. And people calm down and they say, okay, now we'll buy stock again.
Yeah, but you're not going to be able to do that with your
control. That's right. You have a situation where what changes? You say, okay, we're going to open the stock market again. Nothing's changed. You haven't got any more answers for the people. You have no more. You can't prove that you have any more control over the situation than you had yesterday. The minute you open the stock market, everybody sells Shell because Shell's worth nothing. Everybody's going to sell Exxon. It's worth nothing. And then the people who are got cars, they say, well, man, you know, my that's a spinoff. My car's not going to be worth anything. They sell. All the people who have parts, they sell. And then people start selling, and everybody jumps in, and they want to sell what they got before it spins off into their part of the economy where they're holding stocks. And you can't stop it. Tell them you open the stock market, it's going to crash again. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm sure they're deadly afraid. And I put the 64 reasons, but if you take a look at the military mind, they always took the worst case scenarios. And I'm sure that if you saw the actual document of all the scenarios of what they want to avoid, all the things that could go wrong with UFO disclosure, I'm sure the document would have thousands of reasons. It would go on. And any president who saw the document would be so scared after reading that document, there's no way he would ever move. And then they would say to him, okay, Mr. President, and this is what I'm sure they do, if it goes to the president. Now I have my doubts whether it goes to the president anymore. I used to think it did, but I think now it may have been cut out. But if it were going to the president, whoever's in charge, I'd come to you and I'd say, okay, here's the situation. We can either release this and take a look at all these possibilities of things that would happen, or, you know what, we can go, it's not a popular item, but we can go up into Alaska, into the reserve there, and fight off the environmentalists, and we can drill another oil well, and we can put some pressure on Saudi Arabia, and we can force some energy out of the reserves for the military and stuff like this. And what we'll do, Mr. President, is we're going to spend some more money on the UFO thing, and we're going to get more of the answers. We've got these answers. We just need a few more answers. And if you hold off for another 5 years, I think we can get the answers, and we can take on the aliens. We can fight them off, and we can get the answer to abduction. We can get the answer to cattle mutilations. We'll be able to. If the longer you hold off, Mr. President, the better it's going to be. And the president would say, "Yeah, that sounds pretty good to me."
Yeah.
Well, why delay? I mean, it's like for example, Dr. Eric Walker, who was this former president of Penn State University, and this guy knew what was going on. What happened is we knew he knew what was going on. Dr. Robert Sarbacher, who was the guy who talked Wilbur Smith and told him it was all for real and all sorts of stuff, he was asked by Stan Friedman, who was at this crash saucer briefing, and he would go through all these people, Vannevar Bush and Von Neumann, and he was naming all these people, and Stan says, well, can you remember anybody who was alive? And these people are all dead. And he said, well, there's this one guy from Pennsylvania, I don't remember his name. He was a real arrogant guy. He thought he knew everything. And basically, when the research was done, it came out to this Dr. Eric Walker, and the guy who broke the story, Bill Steinman, phoned Sarbacher and said, was it Eric Walker? He said, yeah, that's the guy. He was real arrogant. He thought he knew everything. And he confirmed this is Eric Walker. So we go to Eric Walker, and I was the head of six researchers around the world who were talking to Walker. Walker was a very arrogant guy, and he sort of thought he could talk around it. And he had a problem. He couldn't hang up the phone. He would talk to us on the phone, and he would answer a question with a question. He'd walk around it. But every time he would be interviewed, and he didn't know that we were all coordinated. So we had people in England, United States, Canada. People were interviewing him, and I was coordinating all the interviews, and I was sort of putting it all together, and he would say things like, you're up against the windmills. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. And we would follow up on that. Somebody else would ask him a question 6 months later that was related to that to try to get him to expand on that. What was he talking about with this kind of stuff? And what he told us at one point, and we absolutely knew this guy knew what was going on. He was there at the beginning. He knew all the MJ-12 people. He confirmed that. He wouldn't talk about MJ-12. He wouldn't tell many people were on it. And he kept telling us research something else. And at one point, we were talking to him, and he was saying, come on, like Dr. Walker, you're an old man. You got a chance to disclose this. You could die. You got a chance to make history and stuff like this.
Yeah.
He said, what's the big deal? We haven't blown off the world yet. And that's the whole thing about disclosure, is that the government, if you're going to try to talk whoever's in charge out of disclosing, that's what you're going to say to them. Hey, The world's not coming to an end. Everybody in the United States has got a job. You've got 5% unemployment. What's the big deal? Why would we upset the apple cart? This is all the things that could happen. It's still okay. The gas is, I mean, the gas is high. Yeah, it's $3. But people have got jobs. We got the economy's going good. It's picking up. And you can paint the picture. It's not all that bad in the United States of America. The world's not coming to an end. Bush is getting votes. He got reelected. I mean, if it was so bad, he wouldn't get reelected. If this was an issue that would win, people would run and win on it. But the issues that people have is economy, it's all this sort of stuff, and that's what the politicians are going to deal with. And they see where the votes are, they see which way the wind is blowing, and that's the way they go.
Now, do you think that institutionalized secrecy actually has, like, paradoxically caused disclosure from not happening? Because if they had, like, released the information earlier, maybe there wouldn't be so many unknown, unknowns. If you could open up the research to like everybody instead of how the government controls the information, then disclosure would be more feasible. Do you think that's paradoxically caused the inability to disclose?
Yeah, yeah. That's the other problem they have is that the longer it goes, the worse the situation gets. They get painted more and more into a corner. And that's Linda Howe talks about an intelligence officer that she talked to, who basically told her, "I can tell you from the people on the top that nobody wants to be around when this thing breaks." Yeah. Sort of like, let the next guy release it, not on my watch. Or one guy said, "Not on my watch, you're not releasing this thing."
Yeah.
And it's sort of like you have to admit that you lied. And who wants to go down in history as the president who had this thing break on their watch and had whatever, and it may not be a stock market, but there's going to be some fallout on this thing. That's going to be ugly. And it's like you can see with the war in Iraq. I mean, only one incident to paint your presidency that for the rest of eternity, and that's what these guys work towards is what they're going to look like in the history book. That suddenly you're the guy who had all these bad things happen, and that's all they're going to remember you for, like Watergate. I mean, Richard Nixon got the United States out of the war in Vietnam, but that's not what he's known for. He's known for Watergate. That you can taint your presidency, and that's the key to these guys is how are you going to be seen. So you want to always present things in the best light. You never release anything bad. The government's always going good. Everything's always under control. That's the way the president will always paint the thing. And this kind of thing, there's too much unknown, too much fallout, and the longer it goes, the more information we know that we don't know, and the more you get a situation where you have to cover up. That was one of the things, and I don't know if that's true. People say the cover-up, if you have to release it, then you got to release all the people you had to kill to keep it secret.
Yeah,
the more it goes on, the more corrupt things you're going to find that they had to do to actually keep this thing secret.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of – that's what people don't realize is they think, oh, it's just a simple thing. UFOs exist. Why don't they just say it? What's the big deal? And you start looking at it, and you know, when I wrote this article and I said, you know, I mean, if I was sitting on the committee, I think I'd be voting with them.
Yeah.
I'd vote to say no.
Yeah.
If you actually were on their side, and I always say, if you want to know how to beat them, you have to know how they think. You can't just assume that your side is right. You've got to see, why would someone, it always bothered me. I said, well, why would they cover it up? What are they really thinking? And when I started looking at it, it started giving you all sorts of aspects to this phenomena that you didn't realize before, that there is some stuff. Or when Walker would say, we haven't blown up the world yet, I would sit there and wonder, you know, what's he talking about? I mean, is this true? Or it's a very, very sort of superficial way that ufology has looked at UFOs. It's an interesting, it's sort of like, wouldn't it be neat to know where they're from and, you know, whether they believe in God or this sort of stuff. But it's so much more complex than that. And Walker even told us, and going back 30 years, I'd go back and reread the transcripts and look at the stuff, and all the stuff that he made no sense 25 years ago now makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Lots of sense, where he'd say, unless you have the mind of Einstein, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
He said, you're not going to get anywhere. Leave it alone. There's nothing you can do about it. You're not going to get anywhere with it. And now I'm starting to look at this thing, and you see how complex it is, and you start to realize that he probably was telling us indirectly that they weren't getting anywhere. They tried to figure this thing out, and it was just way over their heads. And that why release it when you have so many unanswered questions?
Now, you, one question I definitely want to ask you, I kind of forgot about. First president you start with on the research is FDR. And have you ever looked at any of the previous presidents? Because I'm thinking of the most notably would be the infamous Aurora crash in Texas that was in, like, the late 1800s.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if there was ever any, like, any mention of something that could be construed as a UFO maybe in past presidencies.
Yeah,
that would have survived some kind of, like, classification system, because back then it wasn't considered something.
Yeah, they didn't really have classified stuff.
Have you ever looked at that?
Yeah, I looked at some of the stories, and basically, unless you go back through the, done a lot of Google searches trying to pinpoint things like that and hoping something in research, there hasn't been any real work done on the files, like all the files, but there were some stories that I tried to track. The one story was a story that was told that President Lincoln had met with two alien people, that two people from space. And I tracked that story every which way, and I couldn't track it down. I couldn't confirm it. The other story that's told is the famous story of George Washington, the meeting, he called it an angel.
Okay.
And where the angel talks about his vision that he's called to bring this, whatever the story was, his role in American history. And the story that you may have a misinterpretation there. And if you read the story, it does seem to be that it could have been an alien. I mean, it could have, he describes it as an angel, but then you also see the thing of the biblical things where people were describing the wheel inside the wheel, and actually a lot of stuff they're describing is alien, and they're just describing it their own way. Again, back in those days, you have interesting scenarios. For example, in the late 1890s, you have the story about the guys flying around in these ships with ropes and anchors and stuff like that. I mean, it's almost like the aliens portray themselves to be a part of the UFOs fit their day. They don't look like the UFOs of today. As if they're screen imaging what they look like. That who knows what they look like? They're just giving us an impression, depending what our belief system is as to what they look like, and we really don't know what they look like. Everything we have is wrong. That they sort of tailor what their ships look like and what their people look like based upon our belief system. And so I did look at a couple, and I still am very interested. I track any story that I can. Those are the only two that I sort of looked at. I looked at, for example, President Roosevelt's vice president, his name escapes me. He was a real, I actually have an article that I'm eventually going to release on presidents and psychic phenomena. A lot of them are big time into psychic phenomena and ghosts and stuff. And Roosevelt's vice president was like a total goofball. They had to get rid of him. But he was so much into you know, astrology and fortune telling and stuff that he actually became sort of an embarrassment. And I looked at his thing, whether he had ever been involved in UFOs, because the Foo Fighter stuff was going on, and really couldn't. But a lot of this stuff, it involves going to the library and going through piles and piles and piles of documents.
Yeah.
And the problem with it is the same as the Kennedy, that unless you've got a lot of leads, it's like I'm up in the middle of Canada, and the closest library to me is, you know, like 1,000 miles away.
Oh, man.
So unless I've got a lot of leads, you would go there and not even know where to start looking. And a lot of these people don't realize how big these places are. Maybe not the old ones, but, you know, Eisenhower, I think, has 28 million pages of files.
Oh,
and Nixon has 41 million pages. So you're looking at a lot of stuff, and unless you know where you're going, and you know where to find it, it's like finding a needle in a haystack, and you've only got a couple of days, say if you're there for a week. And it can be very depressing. I've been very depressed many times in presidential libraries, going for 2 days without finding anything. And then you start wondering, you know, like, maybe there is no UFOs. Maybe the president didn't know anything. Because a lot of these, it's like I went to the Truman Library, for example, and I know it wasn't Truman. I went to Truman, and they said they really didn't have anything. And then I went to the Eisenhower Library, and they do an interview. It's a very formal place. They do an interview before you're allowed to research. You have your research topic, and the archivist sits down and goes over your topic and tells you what they are. And they knew I was coming for UFOs, and they sat me down a couple weeks later, and I was there. And the guy said, well, we've got five documents. I went, five documents? And they showed me, well, there was a fax, and there was the CIA Robertson panel report, and there was, and I'm going, five things? There's 20 million pages, and there's five things, and it's sort of like, where'd the documents go? And then you go through, and you start to, find it, you know, and you look around, and there really, that's all there is. There's not much there, and you start wondering, maybe there are no UFOs. Maybe the president never knew. And you look at people's oral histories inside the White House, and you're you know, there were the interview guys, the oral histories of people like the press secretary. They'll interview him for an hour, and they'll do an oral history, and they'll put it in the presidential archives, what it was like to work with the president, interesting stories about the president and stuff. And I go through all these oral histories, and you couldn't find anything about UFOs either. And you think, well, you know, the Secretary of Defense didn't talk about it. Nobody talks about UFOs. And maybe it's true. Maybe the White House didn't talk about UFOs. Maybe it wasn't a subject. Maybe it was just something that nobody was interested in, and nothing happened. And you get very depressed. So to go back for former presidents that where you have nothing whatsoever to look for, it's like a big risk. I mean, once I retire, I got a couple of years to retire. And then I may just go there for a week and just poke around there, because then you've got lots of time to do it. But now I have to be very specific. Like, for example, the History Channel wanted to fly me down to the Bush Library because I'd never been there. And I said, well, I really don't want to go to the Bush Library. Why? Because there's nothing there. I've done Google searches, and I've asked the library and stuff, and I don't want to go sit there for a week and look stupid. I mean, I get very depressed. I mean, nothing in the Bush Library, and there's no point in going to the Bush Library. So we never did go. But whereas you go to the Reagan Library, then you got all sorts of neat stuff there. And the Carter Library, you got all the rumored stories about the briefing and all the different stories, and you got something to actually check. Or the Clinton is the big one.
Yeah.
I've got 100 FOIA. I'm sure that I got 1,000 pages out of the one agency that was exempt from FOIA during his administration. That was the Science and Technology Office, where the science advisor is. I got 1,000 pages, and I would guess I'll probably get 10,000 pages of documents out of the Clinton Library.
Oh, wow.
Because I know who's there. I know where to look. I know whose files, and I know what the subjects are, and that's what you need. You need a lot of leads to go into a library. And the Clinton, I know them all. And I basically took everybody's story and believed everybody was telling the truth, whether Stephen Greer or whether it was the Rockefeller story or all these people that were involved, and listened to all the rumors and who was involved and who were they talking to in the White House. And I didn't care what it was. It was who were they talking to, what's their names. And then you just file for these guys' files, whether it's later or some of these people have never heard of that were involved, and just ask for their UFO files, their correspondence with Stephen Greer, their correspondence with Rockefeller. Okay. And I'm sure there's going to be lots of very interesting stuff.
Nice.
And that's how you can build a story of what actually happens in an administration.
And on your website, you have you're looking for student UFO essays. I thought I'd ask you about that.
Yeah, I've had it on there for 2 years.
Some that's pretty interesting. Some you're interested in.
I have had it on there for 2 years. I've never had a single one.
Really?
Yeah, I was very interested because a lot of the kids that I took early in the years, I took them. And they were doing science fair projects. And it was always a big thing. I mean, when I'd go lecture at schools, I did lots of lecturing at schools, the kids were just fascinated with this stuff. And then you'd find all these kids would be doing science fair projects on UFOs. It's something that interests kids. And I just figured, you know, we'd get these kids writing in, never got a single one.
What are you, and now are you, you're looking for them though, right?
Yeah. Yeah, any kid that's got a UFO paper or story or the stuff, I'll post it on the website, no problem. I think it'd be interesting for kids. Even if you had schools to access it to see, because it's not at the level of the conspiracy or like my Clinton articles. I've got like 70 pages of Clinton articles. It can be very long and involved and detailed and stuff. You want just some kid, like my kid was never interested in school, really didn't, really hated school, didn't really do much in school, and he did a UFO thing, and it was the old deal that the teacher couldn't believe he had written the project, because he had it from dad, and he heard the stories, and he got all the photographs and put it all together. He was very interested in it, and put it out, and did a fantastic job. But it's the only time he ever really did a project that he ever spent any time on. So I'm sure there's lots of kids that have done some magnificent stuff, or may have local sightings that nobody's ever heard about, photographs nobody's ever seen, personal experiences with their parents that people have never heard about, but. Whether it's the wrong kind of people that are reading the website, or I don't know what's really behind it. I just have to wait and see.
Yeah. Now, you're looking for more like their research or their opinion. I know, like, it sounds like you're not, like, opinions really aren't helpful that much, but would that be something that you think would be interesting because it would give an inclination as to what the next generation thinks of the UFO phenomenon?
For me, it would be more the fact that that I'd never seen it. I wanted to publish it for other people. I'm really not that interested. I mean, unless there's something weird that happens or the kid has some connection that you've never heard about. For example, I got a letter when we broke the Lundahl story about the Navy intelligence officers at the CIA, talking to this alien in the CIA and having this thing fly by the window, the grandson of the guy who was asking the questions actually wrote me, said, "That's my grandfather." And then I said to him, "Well, send me a picture of your grandfather," because I didn't have a picture of the guy, "and tell me about this." And then the kid never corresponded again. But I had no doubt in fact that this kid, because he seemed to know who the guy was and stuff, and he was doing a Google search, and had happened to his father. I can't remember his name, but it was Neesham. It was a weird sort of name, Robert Neesham. And so it popped up, and he said, "Oh, look at this article on my grandpa," you know, and wrote me, and I still have the kid's address. I know where he is, and I tried to get the kid to talk and tell me what he knew about his grandfather and stuff, but I never got. But you might get some weird stuff like that. But it was more the fact that I'd done a lot of lecturing, and I'd seen a lot of science fair projects, and I thought a lot of this stuff would be interesting to post for other schools. And you might get kids interested, and you might get some sort of movement towards disclosure inside schools.
Yeah.
Because you might get something going there where it becomes a popular topic, and all the schools around America come to my website to access these articles. Because I'm sure there's lots of going on in different schools, and it's not collected in any one place.
So you're not really looking for, like, some kid's book report, but more like...
Well, if it's a book report or a project or anything like that, I'm sure a lot of this stuff's going on. I just think it should be put together, and I can easily put it on my website quite easily.
Yeah.
And I would just think that you would have a situation where... I know it was very popular when I was in the schools, that schools thought this was a great thing to have someone lecture on, that you had no problem having the kids sit at attention and listen to this whole thing. And yet there's really no place for kids to go, like if they want to do a project and they want to look at some other kids' project to see what's there. And a lot of times, and every ufologist has had this experience of some kid writing them and saying, "Send me everything you got on UFOs." So,
yeah.
You know, this kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, what kind of stuff do you have available at presidentialufo.com that some of the listeners here might be able to pick up and check out?
Okay, what I have two CDs. The one is, if you're into the Wilbur Smith Canadian government aspect, and Wilbur Smith came out very openly for the Canadian government and said this thing was for real, that there was crashes, aliens exist, and they're here, and talked about the spiritual aspect of why they're here and what they're really here for and stuff like that. I have a CD-ROM of all the material that we were able to collect. His files were hidden. He hid them away. I was able to recover the files, to photocopy them all, and I've got them on one CD, which I sell for the measly total of $5 plus $2 shipping.
Nice.
And it's on my website. The other thing I have is I have a interesting one that has a whole pile of stuff on it. What it has is I have all the audios, except I'm missing the latest Clinton audio where he talks about the fact that he was cut out of the UFO information, and other presidents probably were too. I have all the audios of all the presidents, and what I did is I strung a little story together, and you have little audio links there, and you can hear what did Jimmy Carter say on UFOs. You can actually hear him say it, talk about his UFO sighting. You can hear Ronald Reagan talk about the alien invasion. You can hear George Bush Sr. talk about how he knows what's going on. You can hear Bill Clinton talk about Roswell and the fact that if they had bodies, they didn't tell him about it, and he wants to know. All these different things, they have that. On the same CD-ROM, I have a book, the book of the Charlie Red Star, all the sightings from the 1970s in the big flap that got me involved. And I wrote up all the stories of the people I'd interviewed in these small towns around Carmen, Manitoba, and I put it all in a book, which was never published until now. I put it on the CD-ROM. You can read that story.
Oh, awesome.
I also have on that CD-ROM, I have the book called UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government. It was a book that was published, I believe, in 1989 or 1990, something like that, by MUFON. It was the first book that was ever published by MUFON. It was a book that T. Scott Crane and myself wrote on our investigation of Dr. Eric Walker, who was former president of Penn State University, who knew what was going on. We do a series of interviews with him over 8 years.
Oh,
and when it came down to it, what I said to my co-author, we're not going to edit anything. We're going to take all the interviews. We're going to put all the letters, all the letter, the actual envelopes, because it had weird things happen there. We're going to put it all. We're going to put it all in the book, and we're just going to let people decide for themselves what does this stuff mean, and all the very interesting stuff. Here's a guy who knew what was going on, who helped to cover this thing up for the American government, who was one of the top advisors, who told the American government what to do. and we just put it in a book, and then I talk in that book, we talk about, for example, Robert Lazar, Area 51. This is at the time when Area 51 first broke. We worked on the story. We worked on the MJ-12 document when it first broke, and we have a sort of our own little thing which still stands today to be accurate as to what the MJ-12 document was, why it was released, what it means, this sort of stuff. And that's called UFOs, MJ-12, and the government. That's on that CD-ROM. And that's a CD-ROM I sell for $10 and $2 shipping. And it has, like, the two books and the audio stuff.
Awesome.
And later on, we'll have the we're now working on the book, this Wilbur Smith book. And we're still working on the President's book on the UFOs, which I've had an offer from Mexico to publish it. We're still having a bit of a problem in the United States. I've had some small publishers offer, but eventually we'll have that coming down the road, and it'll have all the stories of the presidents. Basically, the stuff that's on the website, but we sort of put it down to just the stories of the presidents and let you decide what it means. And every president's been involved from Roosevelt on. There's lots of weird stories people haven't heard before, and we'll string them all together and tell you what the presidents knew and what they said about it and what it might mean.
And when do you hope that'll be coming out?
Well, the book has been, we've been trying to push it for about 3 years. I'm going to try a different angle at the end of this year. And I would say if it works, it'll be out within the year.
Awesome.
And the Smith book, it's going to be an e-book, which I really didn't want, except that it's easy to put up. It'll be an e-book. I'd say that's going to be out within 6 months. There's a fellow who's very interested in Wilbur Smith from Great Britain, who's a pretty smart guy. And we're going to put it out. We've actually got some new material. We have a secret project that's being run. It was the U.S. version of Project Magnet. We now have one of the main people working on it who I'm going to interview in the next couple of days and who's offered to tell all about what the U.S. government was doing back in the 1950s, flying planes around, measuring magnetic fields around the Earth. And it all was tied into Wilbur Smith's investigation of UFOs. So this guy's ready to talk. I'm going to be interviewing him, and we're going to go from there and put that book together. I think that'll be out within the year.
Awesome, awesome. Okay, I can ask you about any future lectures or appearances.
No, I have. I supposedly was being invited back to Los Angeles. I have a standing invitation to lecture every year. I lecture at the Ozark Conference in Eureka Springs in April. But unless something changes, I won't be doing any lecturing in the United States because I have the problem of getting a visa.
Yeah.
That unless I intend to go to the border and lie about where I'm going, I can't really get into the States to lecture. So I'm thinking of maybe trying to do a video lecture. I have access to the part of the university here that does lectures for professors and put a video lecture together.
Oh, nice.
Which, because I do a PowerPoint lecture. It has a lot of audio, a lot of video. I like to have people, you know, hear what the presidents are saying. Rather than me just telling you what the president's saying, you can actually hear him saying it.
Yeah.
So I may do one of those where I would put it out to various people who want to run conventions where they can just show it, or maybe even just sell a lecture of the president's story, because it's a very interesting lecture, and I've done it a number of times, and it's fairly long, and it's got a lot of stuff that people have never heard before.
Well, awesome. Thank you very much, Greg Cameron, for sitting down and talking to me for so long, giving me a ton of time and great information, and I'm sure everybody at my website is going to enjoy it tremendously. Your website's www.presidentialufo.com?
Correct.
And thank you very much for appearing on Banal of America Audio Season 1.
Okay, Tim, thanks. Thanks for having me.
That does it for this week's edition of Banal of America Audio Season 1. I want to thank Grant Cameron for giving me just a ton of time and really getting out a lot of information to the listeners of Banal of America Audio. I want to thank Leslie and Chiron of banalofamerica.com for your help and support with the audio series. And, of course, I want to thank all the great listeners out there who've been following along with Banal of America Audio Season 1. Definitely had a big pickup in email correspondence and people writing in about the series, so that's really appreciated, and it's great to hear from the listeners out there and find out what they like about the series and their thoughts on the interviews as we've progressed so far. Next week, it is November 26th, 2005. I'll be taking a rare week off to celebrate the Thanksgiving holiday. And we will return with more Banal of America Audio hijinks on December 3rd, 2005, so 2 weeks from tonight. We'll be back with more Binal of America Audio Season 1. So until then, this is Tim Binal saying so long, have a great Thanksgiving holiday, and you'll be hearing from me in December.